Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. First of all, it is wonderful to welcome back to our program. I almost said our studios, not during COVID. Nobody comes into the studios but the staff. But via Zoom, we're happy to welcome back to our program Nan Calvert, who is a monthly visitor to the program and who always books a really interesting guest who can speak to one issue or a concern related to the environment. But I think today we're not going to be limited to one concern, but probably an array of them, thanks to our morning show guest. Nan, tell us about her.
Well, I'm embarrassed to admit that I did not know about Wisconsin environment until about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Megan delivered a presentation in our area. And so then I quickly went to the website for Wisconsin Environment and found out that this is a very engaged, active environmental advocacy group here in Wisconsin. And I thought it would be really important to have Megan on because they're involved in some wonderful campaigns regarding all aspects of our environment. So one of those, of course, as they all are dear to my heart, but one of them that's especially important right now is the idea of one-time use plastics. And right now, because of COVID, it's almost impossible to avoid one-time use things, but it is something that we need to continue working on, to continue thinking about, and to continue advocating on behalf of reusable things. Things that last a while, because there's only so much room left on the planet for landfills and other things. So anyway, that's why I wanted to have Megan on, to publicize this group, bring awareness to the group, and find out what they're working on. Greg, you're muted.
Yeah, I'm unmuting. There we go. Thank you. So, Megan Severson, State Director for Wisconsin Environment, we are really happy to have you joining us today. Before we learn more about the organization for which you work so hard, tell us a little bit about yourself personally, where you come from originally, and at what point in your life interest in the environment became so important to you.
Thank you so much to both of you for having me on the program. It's really an honor. And I, I think in this time, right, when we can't be together, how great to be able to have a conversation about the values that we share and how great Wisconsin is and all of the natural wonders that we have in the state to appreciate. I live in Madison. I have a family, two stepkids, husband, a cat, but I grew up on a farm in western Wisconsin in Trumbull County, which is just north of La Crosse. It borders the Mississippi River and, across from Minnesota. And I would say that my experience as a kid, well, I didn't realize how special the area was. Growing up on the river, kind of a Huck Finn lifestyle, getting out in the creek and then the river and on a canoe and swimming and playing outside, that certainly informed my, shaped my worldview, shaped my appreciation for nature. And as I went to college at Lawrence University in Appleton and spent time getting to understand sort of politics, how decisions are made, I really, kind of had this two-fold kind of pieces of me that kind of felt like, one, I was really excited about, you know, doing everything we can to protect the environment and knowing how much people care. But then two, like really frustrated at how politics can really get kind of the public desire for, you know, these shared values that we have, that can often get lost in political discourse if people aren't showing up, aren't using their voice. So, you know, for the last 15 plus years that I've been doing advocacy work, it's just, I think it really just comes down to, like, we just need to use our voices and speak about the things that we care a lot about, like the environment.
So when did you come aboard Wisconsin Environment specifically?
Well, I've worked with in this role the last 2 years, but I've worked with Wisconsin Environment and our national affiliate Environment America for over a decade. So my background is really in trainings and overseeing kind of field campaigns, working with sort of people in, you know, sort of outside of the Capitol or outside of the legislative setting and helping people tell their stories, helping people to get their voices into decision makers' offices, whether it's through phone calls and petitions or joining a lobby meeting or planning an event to get attention for a cause they care about. So I've worked across the Midwest for the past decade on all kinds of issues.
So tell us more about the organization itself, and it sounds like it has some kind of affiliation with a broader nationwide organization. Tell us more about Wisconsin Environment and when and how it was founded and maybe kind of the central purpose it serves.
Sure. Well, and you know, the truth is there are a lot of, right, there are a lot of efforts out there, there's a lot of groups, but there's also a lot of work to be done. And Wisconsin Environment, we're a state-based, grassroots-funded nonprofit. We're based in Madison. We have members all over the state. And we don't take any corporate donations, even small businesses. We really value having the support from individual small donors. And, you know, the mission is really simple. We work to protect the places that all of us love and promote core environmental values such as clean air to breathe, clean water to drink, clean energy to power our lives. And we have affiliate state groups across 29 states. They're all part of Environment America. So we coordinate at local, state, and federal levels, and that allows us to, you know, on the one hand, you know, relatively like lean operation in Wisconsin, but we can learn from the successes and challenges of our counterparts in other states, as well as allies with other organizations. Right? And how can we coordinate our efforts to, you know, take on some really big challenges at the, you know, when it comes to defending and moving us towards a more sustainable society.
So what would you say are kind of the centerpieces of what you do to accomplish that in order to try to move the needle on some of these important issues and concerns?
That's a great question. And move the needle is a really great way to think about it. You know, as environmentalists, I think we wrestle with a conundrum, right? We need bold action. We need to make some really big changes, but we also have a short timeline. And in order to make that happen, especially in the political sphere, we need public support. So, you know, we need to do a lot quickly to preserve a livable planet, tackle climate change, protect our drinking water supply, quantity, quality, open spaces. But progress on the environment does require popular support. And that tends to grow and strengthen incrementally as people experience positive change, as they see it around them, as they are impacted by, you know, friends of mine that are on the West Coast, right, dealing with wildfires. I'm even noticing we have some kind of smog in the atmosphere today as a result of wildfires on the West Coast. So as a result, because people tend to need a personal connection to the ability to make an impact, progress usually comes incrementally, one kind of smallish victory at a time. So I think, you know, with Wisconsin Environment, we acknowledge that conundrum and actually embrace it. We do believe in bold action on a large scale, but then we work every day at the local, state levels to build step-by-step that support, you know, that can get effective, long-lasting action. And really that those little victories, they do, you know, kind of spread support across the nation. So every college or city or state that deploys renewable energy, that helps win more people over to the possibility that our world can run on the power of sun and wind as opposed to fracked gas and coal, right? Every company or state that phases out single-use plastic products, it shows more people like ways that we can end that harm done to wildlife by plastic pollution. So I think that it's not just about either what can we do personally or at the local level, or what, you know, big decisions does the president or does Congress need to make. It's how do we kind of tie those smaller victories together to kind of help the snowball effect of getting more and more of these big picture things. And the last thing I'd kind of mention here is just, you know, a couple years ago, California became the second state to commit to 100% zero carbon electricity. And now there are six states, not Wisconsin yet, but six states plus Puerto Rico, Washington, D.C., that have made that same commitment. In Wisconsin, you know, cities like Madison, Monona, La Crosse, Eau Claire, there are counties and school districts that have made commitments to 100% renewable energy and, you know, numerous other kind of commitments. That sort of progress at the local level will help us build that popular support it'll take to get statewide decision makers to make these bigger, bolder commitments.
So is it fair to say that what you spend most of your time doing is, in a sense, in the public sector, trying to elevate and encourage wider and stronger public support for some of these issues? Or do you spend some of your time actually lobbying the decision makers who are also part of that end of things? Or do you leave that to other organizations by and large?
It is a mix of both. And I think that it, you know, in Wisconsin, a lot of the problems that we're facing, I would say that a lot of the work that needs to be done is just showing decision makers how much support exists, right? So there's a great opportunity right now with Governor Evers' Task Force on Climate Change, a whole wonderful, you know, wide array of people from business, environmental, utility, First Nations, all kinds of just backgrounds coming together to put together what should the plan be, what do we need to do in Wisconsin to move off of fossil fuels and to tackle climate change. So this is a perfect opportunity for engaging the public to let decision makers know what should the vision be for Wisconsin. So we really work to engage our members and allies, folks in, you know, Green and Greater Racine and other folks that have, you know, helped to weigh in on what ideas and solutions people would like to see.
For those of you just joining us, Megan Severson is our guest, Nan Calvert and I, on the morning show today. She is state director for Wisconsin Environment. Nan, I want you to say a word more about the presentation that you heard Megan Severson deliver that got you so excited.
Well, unfortunately, I didn't get to hear it.
Ah.
That's how that goes sometimes. So I can't comment on it specifically. So I'll let Megan do that.
So Megan, tell us what your presentation was.
Sure. Well, I'll just cover the whole thing right now. No, the crux of it, you know, kind of came at I would say, I honestly felt honored to be able to speak to the Racine Zero Waste group. This is a really impressive kind of coalition of people from all different kind of areas of the community in Racine and broadly from people working in the landfill and recycling facilities, the city government, businesses, environmental groups, but coming together to ultimately try to solve the problem of how do we reduce the amount of waste going into our landfill. So I've had the opportunity to work with David Rhodes and Racine's sustainability director, Kara Pratt, and just really find out where are there ways that I could support work that they're doing and their efforts to move off of waste. And from Wisconsin Environment standpoint, you know, the big thing that we, and this is something I've personally just learned a lot more about over the last few years, but for my entire lifetime, I'm just under 40, plastics have just been around, right? And it's just something we've taken for granted. And I didn't even, as an environmentalist, think that much about the impact on our environment until 3-4 years ago, when it's really, I think, the science and the research on the impact that's doing to our waterways, to wildlife, even to our health, is really serious. And it's something that we need to take a look at as a systemic problem. And I think the biggest challenge that we face right now is that plastics are really cheap and convenient, and they're a big part of what's driven our consumer economy. America produces an immense amount of garbage, 7 pounds of material per person every single day. But I think what we're all realizing is that when we throw something away, it still sticks around. And in the case of plastics, it's for hundreds of years, maybe even forever. So our focus long term is to really ban them at the beginning, ban the worst offenders. So the polystyrene or styrofoam, takeout foam cups and containers, and other sort of single use items that are also replaceable with durable or biodegradable materials. Ultimately we need to be reducing our plastic consumption, thinking beyond plastic. But then I think what's also timely about the problem right now is, given the COVID-19 pandemic, we're all struggling, right, to, well, one, make sure that we're really keeping ourselves safe. Personal protective equipment mostly is made of plastic, whether it's latex gloves or it's plastic straps on your mask. We need to make sure that healthcare workers are protected. We need to, be protecting ourselves. So that is the top priority. But it does mean we're seeing more of these items thrown around in parking lots and in streams and in landfills. So, I would say long term, at some point in the near future, we do need to have a hard look at the innovative steps the medical community can take to reduce single-use plastic and have more safe options for reusable personal protective equipment. We also, I think, need to do more to educate grocery stores that have already banned single-use plastic bags. But those bans have been lifted in some places out of concern, understandably, to protect people's health. But I think that they're just, this is just a real systemic problem that we need to take on. And ultimately, we need to put more responsibility on the producers of the plastics. We're expecting to see, fossil fuel companies ramping up plastics production even more in the coming years. So it's something that we need really decision makers to take a hard look at. And, what do we want our future to look like here? And I would say that we have a smarter, more sustainable, healthier options than just overwhelming our ecosystem with plastic.
Nan, you're always such an eloquent spokesperson when it comes to the interconnectedness of things. maybe you can speak to why this is a concern that reaches beyond just, you know, how big our landfills get, but the way that it touches other environmental issues.
Well, let me start out by saying that part of the reason we use plastics, and certainly plastics that are one use only, is because of this idea of convenience. So you get it, you use it, you hopefully put it in the recycling bin, hopefully you don't just throw it away. The problem, of course, is that convenience has kind of killed us in a sense. It may be cheaper at the front end, but the real cost of it, the long-term cost of it, is extremely expensive. The cost of it initially isn't what we should be concerned about. It's what happens afterwards. So if you're, you know, we can only recycle certain plastics here anyway. So all of the other plastics go into the landfill, and they really don't biodegrade in anybody's lifetime at this point. There's only finite space for landfills. So is the alternative to burn it? Not if you want clean water and clean air. So the cost is exponential when you think of the long-term consequences of all of this plastic piling up in mountains and mountains in our landfills. And then, you know, if it gets in our waterways, it just kind of stays there. And then, you know, ducks and all kinds of aquatic wildlife are impacted by it. In overt ways, perhaps they get tangled in it, they drown in it, they ingest microplastic beads, they get stuck in it if it's a bottle or something. So it has all these really dramatic long-term consequences that we tend not to see because we don't really want to look at it so much. We enjoy convenience as human beings, but we've got to elevate our thinking about that. We have to think ahead, generation by generation by generation, because, you know, people in the future are going to be left with what we've created as a result of convenience.
And Megan, you were saying that you really want to see some of the responsibility for this shift more squarely to those who produce these kind of things. And produce them for the public. Would you have them stop, or would you have them produce these things in different ways? I mean, what should happen at that end of the equation?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it really, the first thing would be to just ban the things we know we don't need. We do not need polystyrene foam takeout containers, and we know that it's, unfortunately, right now, you know, a local, you know, a small restaurant in Wisconsin that's already struggling dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, the responsibility should not be on them to have to decide, well, this thing is cheaper, right? So I'm going to use this foam takeout container. But if these things are not an option, the things that are just, it's kind of creating this. You know, it's putting the burden on small businesses when really we shouldn't have styrofoam as an option for things, knowing that we have other alternatives that can go down in cost the more people use them. So that's, I think, the big opportunity, you know, the best thing that we need to be doing kind of going forward is to just not have the things that we know are doing real damage to the environment, damage to our health. And when it comes, I was, you know, learning about the kind of the impacts of PPE or the personal protective equipment in the medical community. If you think about the problem of access to N95 masks, there's a problem there when your economy is, you know, the market, it's dependent on a product that you'd have to source from China or from other places. There's more security in having reusable equipment or things that you don't have to rely on, whether a shipment is going to be made. So I think that we can also make our, you know, our day-to-day lives more secure when we have a smarter kind of wisdom of, you know, not relying on these things. So, you know, I think that the, you know, there have been good efforts underway. There's legislation nationally called the Break Free from Plastics Act. And it would sort of serve, it also serves the blueprint for state legislators. But it is something that would, you know, really look at the development of new plastic production facilities, and it also would, you know, kind of think about how do we make sure that the producers have, there's more kind of onus put on them.
Right. Yes, if I could jump in, I think what we forget is that consumers have great power to influence producers. And if we could get a groundswell of consumers to require producers to take responsibility for that which they produce from cradle to grave, so to speak. So let's say you make this certain kind of a plastic bottle. When it's done, it goes back to you as the producer, and you either have to figure out, you know, how can it be broken down and reused again? How can, what can it become? So that it has sort of an endless cycle, you know, to a certain extent, hopefully, you know, for a long time. But I think we forget about that. And again, we are lulled by convenience. We love convenience. So it's tough to break out of that mindset.
Yeah. There was a great piece just last week, an investigation by NPR. And the title is How Big Oil Misled the Public into Believing Plastic Would Be Recycled. I'll share it in the chat here, but it really underscores how much this is a systemic problem that, you know, the plastic we use, it does, there's a profit to be made there by having it be single use. Mm-hmm. So the more people that are aware of that and really pushing decision makers to think first about the public good, the public interest, and the environment, right? And how do we, you know, that's the first thing to do. And then, addressing the system that we, you know, currently operate in is important that we, you know, it's of course gonna take some adjustment, but we know we have people working in recycling facilities, businesses, grocery stores trying to figure it out. There's all kinds of, you know, support from business and industry leaders that would also like to you know, tackle this problem. So I think it's not just environmentalists, it's not just, you know, individual citizens. There's a lot of support for moving us away from this reliance on single-use plastic.
Megan Severson is with Wisconsin Environment. Megan, in our closing minutes, I think it would be good for us to just hear, at least in brief, about some of the other concerns or issues or initiatives that have been important to your organization.
Well, thanks so much. I had a list here. I wasn't sure what all we would cover, from conservation to clean energy, defending the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, protecting clean car standards, protecting bees, waterways. There's so many, you know, we could spend all day having this conversation. You know, one thing I'll just mention that this is a really tough time for everybody right now, right? And it's hard to find the good in the news sometimes. And when day-to-day can be so hard, whether you're dealing with, you know, not being able to see family or concerned about family members' health or having kids in virtual school or not in virtual school, there's a lot of worries people have. So I would say that one of the projects this year that has been most rewarding is helping to connect more people with nature and just really encourage people to, in, you know, safe ways that they can, following local, state, and CDC guidelines, you know, get out into nature. And especially if you have kids, if they're learning at home, you know, find a nearby nature preserve or a park, or, you know, my stepson is 7 and he's learning how to fish. and, you know, take up a new hobby or you know, resurface an old one and just get into nature and enjoy the sounds of the birds and, you know, looking up into the trees. Like, these things really do give us a lot of, nurture us in this time. And, you know, and then some good news I'll share is that this last month, the Great American Outdoors Act, which it fully and permanently funded the Land and Water Conservation Fund at $900 million annually. The act also provides $9.5 billion over 5 years to fix maintenance problems, backlogs for America's public lands. This is a big deal of, you know, just bipartisan support. For years and years, we have not had this fund permanently funded. The funds get moved to other places. And what it means is that programs in Wisconsin, from everything like, you know, this fund has supported the Ice Age Trail, the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, but it also supports local access to nature. So in southeastern Wisconsin, you know, bike trails along Lake Michigan, playgrounds, high school ball fields, tennis courts, neighborhood parks. So it's something that is a bit, you know, either under the radar or it's not, definitely not tackling climate. There's a lot of problems in Congress with their approach to the environment right now, but I would say when it comes to protecting nature, like, this is a good step forward, and it's one that we're really glad to see because it does mean more support for access to nature in Wisconsin and across the country in the coming years.
Very good. So how is it that ordinary citizens can be part of the specific efforts of Wisconsin Environment?
Oh, thank you so much. Well, people can go to our website, wisconsinenvironment.org. And what's great there is you can look at the list of issues that we work on and, you know, kind of find if whether it's conservation and parks, clean water, climate, clean energy, waste issues. There's lots of information. We also, I didn't talk about, we do quite a bit of kind of research and report writing. So you can kind of click on that. And then if you're also looking for something locally to do, I'm happy to help introduce you to other activists and organizations that are working on issues that might be more in line with what you're interested in too. So you can go to wisconsinenvironment.org, or people can also email me directly, megan@wisconsinenvironment.org.
Very good. Very good. Nan Calvert, I know you have a couple of announcements before we go today.
I do, and it just echoes what Megan just said. I think that we could all use a little bit of celebration and joy in our lives. And so to do that, on September 22nd, the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center will hold their fall equinox celebration. But this year, it's virtual, and you can join in at 7 p.m. on Facebook Live. So there's going to be a bonfire and a drum circle. And if you don't have a drum, it doesn't matter because you can make one. There will be a step-by-step video with instruction by Heather Priner. And so you too can join in. And then hopefully, if the weather's nice, you can go outside in your own yard and look at the stars and enjoy this astronomical event, the fall equinox celebration. Again, at the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center, on September 24th, they're going to have their first ever virtual trivia night. The fee is $10. Go to their Facebook page, Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center, or go to their website. You can look at all of the details, sign up. There's still plenty of time to form a team and join in virtually on September 24th for the trivia night. It should be great fun.
Sounds wonderful. And of course, yes. Dan, you also like to always remind people that they should really continue to support in whatever way they can any of the environmental organizations that mean something to them.
Absolutely. The trails are open. The trails are open. Get out there with your friends and family, socially distancing appropriately. You know, it's fall. All of the goldenrods are blooming. The asters are blooming. Fall migration is going on. It's a perfect time to get outside. So please support your local nature centers in any way you can.
Nan Calvert, we appreciate you arranging today's morning show visit. And Megan Severson from Wisconsin Environment, the state director. It was great to have you be part of this conversation today. Best wishes to you and everybody at Wisconsin Environment. And thank you for being part of today's morning show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Megan.
Tell us where you... The time is 8:46. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is a much-loved interview I recorded back in 2008. I can't remember being quite this excited in quite some time at the prospect of an interview, because it is with the author of an absolutely wonderful book about the work that doctors do. The book is called Better: A Surgeon's Notes on Performance, and the author is Atul Gawande. Dr. Gawande is a general surgeon at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He's also a staff writer for The New Yorker and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard School of Public Health. And his first book is called Complications: A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science, a bestseller. And this next book is equally interesting and potentially valuable. And Dr. Gawande, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me on.
This is a book about how doctors can be better doctors and how they can look at their own performance and better themselves. You say that betterment is a perpetual labor. And I suppose that's, in a sense, kind of bad news. One hopes a quick fix or a simple solution might be in order, but in fact, this is something that anybody interested in bettering themselves needs to really consider.
Yeah, I started asking the questions about how some doctors get better results than others, because I entered my own practice as a surgeon in 2003, so only about 4 years ago. And I was trying to understand how I might get better at what I do. And there turned out to be a sort of core lesson that I found very interesting. When I looked at the people who were getting better results than everybody else, they weren't necessarily smarter than other people. They weren't even necessarily better trained. Instead, they were willing to look at their mistakes. They were willing to look at their failures, to acknowledge them openly, and then try to be innovative about how to solve them. And, you know, that kind of openness and willingness to look through your own failures to find solutions turned out to have lessons that cut across lots of areas of medicine. It went to everything from hand washing to how military medical teams in Iraq were managing to save more lives than ever before in history. And that was where the connection came from for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, towards the top of the book, you say, in medicine, as in any profession, we must grapple with systems, resources, circumstances, people, and our own shortcomings as well. And I guess what you're saying is that there's one kind of person who just sort of throws up their hands in the face of all that and sort of gives up or gives in somehow, and you are suggesting an alternative which is so much more satisfying, which is of coming up with ways in the face of all those things that are imperfect, including ourselves, and going for the very, very best results you can possibly achieve.
Yeah, the puzzle is how to have any optimism in the face of what is an incredibly complex society nowadays. I work at a hospital that, in our system, we have 10,000 employees. I mean, it's hard not to begin to feel you're just a white-coated cog in the machine, and just making anything go right. You know, I had to order an x-ray for a patient today, and I did not want them to get an injection of the IV contrast they give for CT scans. Now, in order to make sure they didn't get this injection, I could write it on a little piece of paper and see what happens. But I know that someone can screw that up, and so I got to call downstairs and make sure I talk to the radiologist in charge and say, you know, don't give this patient that stuff you always give them. And you know, it can be frustrating, but that's the only way you start to make better results. It's the only way you start to actually rise on the curve and distinguish yourself. And the irony of it is it makes your life and your job more purposeful. You feel you are accomplishing something by doing something more than just checking the check boxes and doing your ordinary job day to day. You're trying to ask yourself, how do I take responsibility for these people who've trusted themselves to me and give them a result that has a chance at being better than it was last year? And we aren't going to always succeed, but people know we're not perfect, but they want to know that we're trying to aim for perfection.
You said just now something about in order to sort of move yourself along the curve of improvement or some sort of words to that effect, which brings to mind one of the most striking things in your book, the fact that a recent study of results of the work of doctors, I think those dealing with cystic fibrosis, revealed very distressing results, a certain bell curve that was not expected. Briefly explain this to our listeners, because it strikes at the heart of why your book is so important.
Yeah, this is the story of patients with cystic fibrosis, and these are children who are born with this terminal illness that the average survival is only 33 years. Now, that said, there is a wide bell curve for this illness, just like everything else in medicine. That is, there are some places that get better results than everybody else. And I went to one of those places. It's the University of Minnesota program in Minneapolis, run by a guy named Warren Warwick. And at their program, their average child will live 14 years longer than elsewhere. And they do it by, not because, you know, I went there thinking, okay, you guys have a secret drug that no one else has. But they are using the same treatments everybody else is, the same guidelines, and they get different results. And the reason is they actually pay attention to their details. They track how often the kids that are supposed to be getting their treatments actually get their treatments at home. If they aren't getting the treatments at home, they follow through to figure out what to do to get them back on the treatments. They look over each other's shoulders to say, you know, we have 7 doctors in this place and about 12 nurses all taking care of these kids. Is everybody on the same page? Are we really doing the same things? These are things that we don't normally do in medicine. And we ought to. We ought to learn from the folks like that are at the top of their curve. Cystic fibrosis is unusual. They put their results on the web publicly for everybody to look at. You can know what the difference is between an ordinary center, a lousy center, and a great center on the web. We're just starting to do that. Last month, the government put on the web the results for hospitals and their cardiac care, and that is starting to spread throughout medicine. And that many of us in medicine are afraid of it. We criticize it. We get angry about it. But the truth is, it's an opportunity for us, because in my own field, I'd love to know who really is the best cancer surgeons for the kinds of cancers I take care of, because I would go and learn from them. I'm sure I would get some pearls that would let me do better at my job.
One of the things you track at one point in your book, you've touched on it already briefly, is the fact that in terms of keeping our soldiers alive and well, that we have made some remarkable breakthroughs in recent years, after I think you talk about a fairly long period of plateau in which the percentage of soldiers in battle killed remain relatively steady after many years of advancing improvement. And now recently, some tremendous breakthroughs have been made in which more and more of our soldiers caught in combat survive. But of course, that brings to the fore other situations and challenges and so on. But you learn some interesting things about how this long-awaited breakthrough is being achieved out there.
Yeah, you know, soldiers wounded on the battlefield, about 25% of them have died for the last 50 years. You know, in the first Persian Gulf War, a little over a decade and a half ago, 25% of the soldiers wounded in the desert there died. Today, it's less than 10% die. And that's the breakthroughs that you talk about. What's really interesting about them is there is no major technological breakthrough. There's no major new discovery. Instead, they've taken the know-how we already have and made sure we're using all of it as well as possible. And so, for example, looking at their statistics about what has happened, where are our failures, they discovered that soldiers were coming into the hospitals with wounds to their heart and lungs from bombs going off that shouldn't have happened if they had the Kevlar armored vest working properly. And that's when they realized they weren't wearing their vests. They were leaving them off. And so they held commanders responsible. They made a new rule that they were responsible for making sure their troops wore their vests all the time. And the result is a dramatic drop in the number of deaths. They found that even after they were saved by the vests, they were still dying on transport from the battlefield to the hospital. And so they moved the surgeons into tents out closer to the battlefield. And they did this despite the fact that the surgeons complained about it. They said, how can we do surgery without all the technologies we normally use? The orthopedic surgeons didn't have x-rays. They were forced to go back to 19th century techniques of finding fractures by feel. And yet doing this, they saved more lives than ever in history. They saved people that have never been saved before, people with triple amputations and 90% of their body burned and major brain injuries. Our burden now is, just as you say, having learned to do this and having been diligent enough to take that know-how and save so many people, we now have to figure out how to give those folks a life worth living and a quality of life with their rehabilitation.
Hmm. You say it, the paradox at the heart of medical care is that it works so well and yet never well enough. That has to be one of the toughest things about this job, is that because so often there is so much at stake, that for all the good that is done, even the smallest of mistakes can lead to disaster. What a mantle of responsibility which you and your colleagues wear.
Well, part of what I want to talk about in this book is that anybody who takes responsibility for other people, in fact, has that level of responsibility. They have that kind of moral obligation. It's you as a teacher or as a policeman or in any job where you are saying, look, trust me, we have this responsibility. Now, in my job, in a year, I'll do about 350 operations. 98% of the time, it's going to go very well, and I'm really proud of that. But 2% of the time, I will have major failures. I will have a complication that leaves someone worse off rather than better off, or they could die. And that means about 6 to 8 people a year I have hurt rather than helped. And I could ignore that, but what I think we owe people is thinking hard about how to make those cases go better next time, and also think about what I owe those 6 or 8 people as individuals. I owe them my help, my attention, more time. I should give them more time than other people. And we, as a society, knowing that there are going to be a certain rate of complications, have to have a way to actually help those people when they're hurt. And thinking through that in all of our professions, I think, is something that we're missing because of that idea, you know, that we always talk about positive thinking. That's what we need in this country to succeed. In fact, we need a willingness to think sometimes about the negative sides as well, and that's what will make us better.
The book is Better, A Surgeon's Notes on Performance, published by Henry Holt and Company, and the author, Dr. Atul Gawande. I thank you so much for writing this great book.
Well, thank you for having me on and being so generous.
And tomorrow on the morning show, a couple of different interviews, including one with Beth Bender and Pasquale Lorino from the Racine Symphony Orchestra, with performance arts groups all over the world right now in such a strange state of near paralysis. Many of them are trying to find out ways to still remain active and viable. The Racine Symphony is offering a portion of Vivaldi's Four Seasons this weekend, and we'll find out all about it tomorrow. It's exactly 9 o'clock. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College.